Hello, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for coming here today. Danny, thank you for joining us. I would also like to thank your brother Anthony for giving me the opportunity to make this possible during our social policy board the last term. It is great that you have come to talk to us about what you see going on today. It matters that it is you, because like many of us here, you grew up in Oxford. And although you have traveled around, you have always come back to where you belong. What you see and say matters, because it reveals something of the realities that make the lives of many people struggling to be acknowledged and treated as human. So welcome to Ruskin. Although you are a professor at the other university, we would like to thank you. We would like to think that this is your spiritual home. The idea of work as a service is particularly relevant for many of us, and it is one that is under attack and felt by those involved in the fields of community development, youth work, and public service generally. So thank you again for making this the subject of your talk today.
Thank you.
When you see some of the slides, you won't be clapping so much. Because I'm going to make your tutors look good, because I'm going to put up some slides that are completely unreadable, but we'll skip over those. I should say, my brother Ant has a real job, a hard job. He looks after kids leaving care and asylum-seeking children in Oxford. So he does the kind of job that I think many of you may be doing already or going on to do, and he doesn't work for profit. He works for service because you wouldn't do it for the money. Now, in theory, I'm also in public service, but of course I'm not, because universities in Britain have been privatised, and that changes what we're like. I can remember going to university when universities were entirely a public service, and the ethos was different. The concerns with, are you making more money? Are you getting enough students in? Where are your research grants? Don't worry about what you're doing with that research money, just get another research grant. They weren't there. And if you want an example of the problems of moving towards a profit motive, looking at what's happened to the higher education sector across Britain gives you an idea for that. I'm going to talk a little bit about Europe halfway through this, and a lot about what's currently happening and what is happening in the areas you're working in or going to work in, the problems, and how I think we will begin to get out of it in the medium or long term. But the next few years are going to be particularly tricky. We could just talk about healthcare. Who's doing the access course for healthcare? It's an idea. A few people. Who's doing training for social work? Great. This is actually mainly a social work crisis. I'll let you read that if you want to know the detail. But in the last few years, we've had the first increases in mortality rates in Britain that we've seen for decades. It began in 2012 and 2013 with elderly people, particularly elderly women. Life expectancy of women over 65 fell by about 5 weeks in 2013. And it correlated very closely with the fall in the number of adult social workers and the visits to elderly people that used to be funded, which have more than halved since 2010. We've had the deepest cut in health and care funding that we have ever had since 2010, and maybe it shouldn't have been a surprise who was actually hit by this, but it was a surprise to people like me. What we were looking out for when the recession first hit was young people doing badly, because we can remember the early 1980s recession. There was an increase in youth suicides, an increase in drug overdoses and so on. Then the elderly didn't do that badly in the 1980s recession. This recession was different, because this recession was accompanied with cuts in services. and we suddenly discovered who it was who most relies on services. And the group who most relies on services are not the poor, not young people, are not people on benefits. The group who relies above all else on public services are the very elderly, people aged around 85 and around 90. The figures were released on the 23rd of June this year, and so nobody noticed them because there was a little referendum on the 23rd of June, and then there was a lot of news after the 23rd of June. But on the 23rd of June we found out that 52,000 more people, 52,000, had died in 12 months to summer 2015 as compared to 12 months before. That 52,000 rise was much bigger than the rise that had been thought to have occurred a few months earlier when the preliminary data came out. It represented a 12% increase in the death rates of 90-year-olds. People don't tend to worry about 90-year-olds. They've made it to 90, but it's still quite shocking. 9% rise in 85-year-olds, I think about a 7% rise in 75-year-olds. So it was people who were older, and not necessarily people who were poorer. This rise in deaths occurred all across the country, almost everywhere, except not in West Oxfordshire for some reason. But other than that, you saw the rise almost everywhere. And that starts you thinking, why? What could have caused something like this? The government's initial response, by the way, was influenza. This was a flu epidemic. But influenza tends to have a big effect in about 5 weeks. It tends to affect the young more than the old, and influenza was a very minor part of the rise in death. The bulk of the increase in death on death certificates was put down as people dying from dementia and Alzheimer's. But it really means they're very frail and very old, and death certification is particularly reliable at these ages. These were people from all walks of life who'd made it to an old age. In fact, not from all walks of life. And here's the irony. They've made it into their 80s, 85, 90. Most of them have been middle class, but they were younger, getting their ages, who had come to rely on social workers visiting them, on Meals on Wheels being delivered to them, Meals on Wheels were cut, on rural bus services, which were cut because they'd retired to that nice little house in the countryside, on hospitals being able to deal with them when they were brought in by ambulance. The government had said, oh, we've looked after the old, because we've given them a triple lock on their pensions. And so look, statistically, the elderly have done well. And what we learned was that a triple lock is of absolutely no use to you when you actually have need. When you fall ill and you require people to look after you and to keep you going so that you can live another 3, 5 or 10 years longer. And this was quite new. And the shocking thing about it, still, is that not one of the four chief medical officers of the UK, there's one for Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales and England, not one of them has yet commented on this rise in elderly deaths in the country. And that has to make you worry. To put it in context, if you calculate it mid-year to mid-year, it's a 9% rise in deaths. Deaths normally go down all the time. They've gone down for 150 years. It's a 9% rise in deaths for the mid-year to mid-year period, which is the largest increases in mortality in any year since 1940, when deaths increased because people were bombed in a war and soldiers were brought back from Dunkirk and died of their injuries. David Cameron almost certainly is the first post-war Prime Minister to have left office with falling life expectancy. Life expectancy is the single key statistic that is used to measure what is happening in a country. For life expectancy to be falling, you have got to have failed in a rich affluent nation. What scares me and why I think you've got a challenge ahead has been the general lack of interest in this particular story. I'm mainly going to talk to you about education and schools in a bit, but this one matters. And it is almost as if, without being spoken, people in power get it. That yes, when we cut services, when we have crises in the health service because of the funding and they can't cope anymore, when you have over 4-hour waits on trolleys in hospitals in A&E and it's elderly people on those trolleys, it'll be the frail and the elderly who die more. But the unspoken assumption is this is a price worth paying. If anybody's going to suffer, I've even heard people say to me, well, I don't want to live to 92. And that's the atmosphere we are in Britain. It's not the attitude I have, but I think it partly explains where we're at. And once you begin to think, well, it doesn't matter if our quality of service for the very elderly isn't as good as it was a few years ago, the danger then is what happens next. What you next decide doesn't matter as a standard. Hospitals have their funds delegated down to them, so they're blamed when they can't cope because they're supposed to cope. I think we have a 2.65 billion deficit at the moment in the NHS. That is set to get worse. It would be easy to solve if we just made the new Duke of Westminster pay his full inheritance tax, you could wipe off the NHS debt. But we think, we being the elite of Britain, think it's more important not to tax the very rich if they can find a loophole than to fund our health service, and particularly our social work service, at a decent level. Do you remember the £350 million a week that was said, if you vote leave, you'll get an extra £350 million on the health service? It was technically speaking bullshit. Supposing you wanted to have the health service of the equivalent that they have in Germany, you can work out quite easily what you'd have to spend, because we know how many people there are in Germany, we know how many people there are here. We know for the OECD how much money is spent per person in Germany on state healthcare, a little bit of private healthcare, more state. Here we have more spending on private. And you'd have to spend about 1 billion and 70 million more a week to get German quality healthcare. So a billion every week. Forget the 350 million. If you really want a decent health service, it helps we've got a very efficient NHS model, but we fund it less per head than anywhere else in Western Europe, other than Greece and Germany. And we've only managed to beat Greece and Germany because they've had to make the most almighty cuts because their recessions have been even worse. I grew up here, as you said, in the 1980s, and we've seen this before. I can remember the health service being cut in the 1980s, and the ultimate callousness. I always thought, if you're trying to get into the minds of people who think that profit really matters, and service doesn't matter. The ultimate callousness were the intensive care beds, which were the old Radcliffe and now will be at the JR next to here on the hill. We only had 8 intensive care unit beds in the main hospital in Oxford. That's 8 for the entire county. Those 8 beds were often full. If the Prime Minister was in a major road accident on the way back from Chequers, in theory, if the bed is full, there is nowhere else to put them. And yet the Conservatives in the 1980s thought that was okay because a cost-benefit analysis told them that the cost of providing one extra bed wasn't worth the amount of money you'd lose on average for an average life. We value a life about 4 times less than they're valued in Scandinavia. Or we did back in the 80s, and we are heading there again. I know this is a bit depressing. I'm going to try and make it more fun as we go on, but that is the worst part of the current story. As falling life expectancy. The last statistic I'll give you on that, in Scotland we've collected data for 160 years on health, and every 3 or 4 years life expectancy is worked out, and for every single period in those 160 years life expectancy has gone up, or at least it's gone up for either men or women. Sometimes it stops going up for one or the other. In the most recent 3 years, it's the first time in 160 years that it hasn't gone up for either men or women, and this is about to go down because of the cuts in austerity in Scotland. So you are living and working in extraordinary times, as shown by what has actually happened to people. And this didn't come out of the blue. People actually said that their health was getting worse before this. The proportion of the population who said that their health was getting worse rose 2011, 2012, 2013. It was part of David Cameron's Happiness Index, which was designed in 2010. You might be able to remember that. Nobody ever checked the Happiness Index to see what was happening to it. And on the key components on health, people said they were getting less happy, and then we get this big rise in death. That's the other figures about death, but that's really enough to say about that, except to say it has really hit the elderly. And this is often forgotten. And it may be linked to other things. So it could be linked to why 52% of the population, mostly old people, voted to leave the EU. Because people were presented with a choice on 23rd of June between business as usual or something different. And if your lives have actually been getting materially worse, and they tell you you really ought to stick business as usual, I think it partly explains why the elderly did tick, in particular, for something different. I don't think they were necessarily being that selfish. I think they're worried about their grandchildren, because they're not going to live for that much longer regardless. But I do think we've often characterised what's happening in this country as a kind of war between the old and the young, where it's the young who have lost, the young have had their education funding cut, the young are made to get student debts, the young are in generation rent and have to work forever, the young have youth unemployment. Look at the elderly who benefited from the welfare state and had an easy life all their time. And that's why I labour it about it is them who are leading the big increase in things getting worse. And the worry is about who doesn't care. That's it on health. Begins to get a little bit less depressing now. We'll talk about housing. How's it going to get less depressing? Back to my title about working for profit or service. One thing that social scientists worldwide have not yet done a good job of working out, in my opinion, is when is something better provided by somebody who's trying to make a profit, and when is it better provided by somebody who's trying to offer a service. This is called the knights and knaves kind of argument. So in the health service, the idea was in the past, people working in the health service were knights, they were valiant, they would give themselves up and work very hard because they wanted to work in service, but they could also be knaves and be lazy. So you have to introduce a profit motive into the health service to make sure that they work. I think it's very easy to show, but I know it's easy to show, that in healthcare you do not want anybody making a profit. If I'm a profit-making nurse or doctor, and you're my patients, and I prefer to provide healthcare, I really want you to be ill. Quite ill continuously, please. It's no good if you're all healthy. I'm out of a job. So, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to work out why you don't want a profit motive in healthcare and why you have to rely on people working in service. The worst examples of the profit motive in healthcare are seen in the United States, where it makes sense for a private hospital to put somebody in a vegetative state, because then they can just carry on charging for the procedures that they do. So Let's assume, and we're busking, so assume we've agreed on that one. The next sector, which is what I'm mainly going to talk about, I won't go on too long, don't worry. I do get bored of my own voice as well. The next sector that I think is fairly obvious you don't want to make a profit is education. We tend to avoid profit making in education. The best example of this is private education. Private education in Britain is almost all charitable. Now, most of you will have come across this as with people saying it's terrible that private schools can claim a charitable status and avoid paying tax. And there's often an argument on the left that says we should get rid of the tax exemptions on private schools because they're not really doing something particularly charitable. But if you were to get rid of their charitable status, you would then have a profit-making private education sector. And again, you have to look to the United States to see what that's like. And in universities, it means private universities in the States that spend more money on marketing their courses than they spend on their lecturers and tutors. Because what matters is getting people in. What doesn't matter is what you actually do with them. It's all about making money. The upper classes insist on sending their children to charitable schools because the upper classes know that somebody trying to make a profit out of their children would not do a good job of teaching them. So I think you can argue that in education, the profit motive is largely a bad thing, and I'll argue later that competition is a bad thing. But what about housing? This is where it begins to get tricky. And we've moved in this country from seeing housing shortly after the war as largely a state obligation, to now seeing it as something where you really want to get the state out of housing as much as possible and just have a market. And again, it's changed most remarkably in the last few years. Between the last two censuses, the number of people in private renting doubled from 5 million to 10 million. All around this city, whenever somebody sells a house or a flat, it's the landlord trying to get it first. We are seeing a rapid return to the past. The majority of people who are made homeless now are made homeless because they come and pay the rent price that their landlord has put up on them. So we could talk, and if you've got questions later, we could talk about housing, what can you do about housing. But to my mind, part of the problem with housing is this belief that the market is somehow efficient. And if you leave something to the market will balance out and it will work. And we've proven by the road we've gone down that that really, really doesn't work. And it's not mainly that the private market will not build housing. It's that the private market in an unequal country distributes housing ever more inefficiently each year. The stereotype example of this is the maisonette in London that used to house a couple and their two children, so four people in the maisonette. That maisonette is purchased under right to buy. The people who purchase it under right to buy sell it to a landlord. The landlord rents it out to whoever will pay the highest rent and keeps on pushing the rent to see what they can get. And what they end up getting is a young lady who works in a bank who isn't a bit upset that she's having to live in this squatty maisonette on her own, that used to house four people in an estate in London where there's still signs saying no ball games, but there aren't any children to play games anymore. It's an incredibly rapid way to waste space in housing is to allow the market to determine what need is. The market doesn't work in housing because you do not have a choice not to be housed. If you could all decide that you didn't want to go and sleep somewhere tonight, but at 8 o'clock you're going to press a button, disappear up into the cloud, and come back down again at 8, then the market would work fine. Because you wouldn't pay for housing or rent unless it was reasonable, you'd have another option. But because you have no exit route, no real choice, the market goes, what? The market works when you have actual choice, including not taking part in the market. So the market for clothes works quite well. Some of you, I can see, are a little bit bored about clothes. Right? You've decided that you want to spend a bit of money on clothes, you've gone and chosen your clothes, you probably buy too many clothes as far as I'm concerned, but you've chosen to do that. And you don't have to go shopping and buy that number of clothes, it's fine. The market's perfect for socks. The market works for you for clothes because of people like me, who really don't care what they wear. I know I have to have some clothes, but you know, I've discovered you can actually wear them out. And the great thing about wearing out your clothes is you don't have to go shopping, and I really, really don't like buying clothes. So the market works for goods that are often small and cheap and produced in multiple numbers. It doesn't work when you have natural monopolies, absolute need, and also you can't learn from your mistakes. So you've all got to learn when you buy something that doesn't fit, or there's a mistake, or looks really stupid, you buy different clothes. But you're only really getting one go of education. You've got no chance to repeat your education when you're 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. And your parents were not experts in education at all. They had no idea, unless they were really strange. You know, why should your parents really have known? You're not a consumer. You've chosen to come here, but you really only have one or two shots at higher or further education. You're not well informed. I'm relatively well informed because I've worked in bloody education for 27 years. Right? I have an idea. A bit late for me because I don't want to become a student again. There's a really asymmetrical relationship between students and the institutions that they're in, so it doesn't work. Housing, I think, is an example where we need to begin to rebalance it. We need social housing, but we don't need social housing of the kind we've had before. And one massive problem that the left in Britain has is that it's rather like Theresa May. Yeah, Theresa May is selling the 1970s. She's selling the early 1970s before we were a member of the European Community. She's trying to sell grammar schools as being good because that's back to the early 70s, late 60s. And what are Labour doing? They're selling Defend council houses, Defend comprehensive schools. Again, they're selling the past. The kind of things that I think you want to do with housing are things like introduce the right to sell, where instead of being evicted if you've got a mortgage, you can demand that your house is transferred to a housing association, you can become a tenant and stay in it. This would suddenly mean that Old Headington here, which is, you know, quite a cute looking area, but largely privately owned with some mortgages, would stop being such a stuffy area as it currently is. It's stuffy because you can only live there if you can afford to live there. And if you become slightly normal, lose your job, split up, or someone become ill, you've got to go. But if you didn't have to go, if you split up, lost your job, or became ill, but could become a tenant, it would suddenly alter the nature of your neighbours here, which would then alter the nature of the kind of complaints you ever get about planning applications around this area. It would also alter the amount of money that people are willing to pay for houses in certain parts of Oxford because they're not near social housing, because your neighbour could become, in effect, a housing association or council tenant. But there are other things that we need to do, from briefly on housing, and then I'll zip through slides on education. These fields out here, they look very nice, don't they? Very pretty. I never saw those fields before I came here a couple of years ago, because you can't see them. You can only see them from up here out of these windows. You can't actually see this green belt part of Oxford. You're not protecting the view for very many people. In fact, they are building on, that's West Barton, isn't it? Barton Park is being built on. There's a very large employer very near here that desperately needs people to work in it, that in the next 20 years is going to see a doubling in the need for its services. That employer is called the John Radcliffe Hospital. That hospital needs porters, it needs nurses, it needs lots of admin staff and technicians, and it needs a few junior doctors. If you're a junior doctor now, which isn't really junior, you tend to be about my age, and you're fairly well paid, two of you can buy a small house near here and share it, but you're the only people who can actually house yourselves. So if we're going to make sure that this hospital can actually look after people like me in my old age, we're going to have to do something with those fields. Now, we could give them to Ballots. And Ballots would build small houses with four bedrooms, with a tiny gap between the next small house with four bedrooms and two parking spaces, because that's how you make the most money. Alternatively, you don't let Ballots do it, you actually plan for what you need. And what you need wouldn't necessarily be housing for the staff of the JR. It might well be up to five-storey apartments for the elderly of Headington, so they can leave their family houses that they're sitting in their 70s and 80s and 90s and move to an apartment with a nice view back at the city. And you've suddenly got a house which you can then use for people who might want to work in the JR, might want to start a family for the teachers who work there. But you've got to plan all these things. So if you leave it to the market, you get the mess that we currently have in Oxford. Average price is 16 times average incomes. Just building houses won't solve it. I don't know why we've got into this situation of not being progressive anymore. But we used to argue for things we didn't have. So there was a time when we argued for having schools that we all went for rather than separate grammar schools and secondary modern and technical schools. There was a time long before that when we argued for a health service and then we got it and we hadn't had it before. There was a time long before that when we argued for state housing when we hadn't got it before. And for some reason, we are no longer arguing for things that we haven't ever had, despite the fact that we can often go and look at mainland Europe and find examples of people who've got these things that we'd like. And if you want a really decent kind of school, you go look at Finland. If you want nice housing tenure compared to us, you look at Germany or the Netherlands. If you want a really decent health service, go and look at Switzerland. In Switzerland, they really worry about what they spend on health, because they spend twice as much per person than we do. They spend the highest on health in all of Europe. But when you've got lots of money, what is it sensible to spend on? Schools. This is your standard kind of letter to the Guardian. And I'm going to argue it isn't enough. Last one of the signatures of the letter, so it's fine to argue. But you're getting lots of these kind of things about how terrible Theresa's plan to bring back grammar schools is. Last week in the Times, 60 organisations signed a letter, including the Royal Society of Arts and Commerce. But I don't think it's good enough. And I also think there is an attraction of grammar schools, which is very similar to the attraction of Brexit. It isn't just the idea that your children, or more importantly, your grandchildren, because mainly old people who are in favour of bringing back grammar schools, 61% of people who went to the grammar school would like to grammar schools. It's not just that you might think that your children would benefit from getting this slightly more selective education and passing 11 plus. I think it's also that quite a lot of people, and particularly grandparents, are watching their children going through our state schools at the moment, our academies at the moment, being made to do homework every other night, being tested every other year, and being pushed to get the highest GCSEs they can, simply because that's what the school's telling them to do. And you look at that, and secondary moderns are partly a way out of that. It would possibly be a better school for your child if they weren't being pushed, because you don't actually learn that much when you get a C or an A, when somebody has forced you to get a C or an A. A few more graphs, less text. Here's the drop in GDP per capita that we currently have. See the little grey area? That's a change since 1950. Every other recession since the war hasn't mattered. All the ones that I've spent the bulk of my working life writing angrily about how absolutely terrible it was as it occurred are insignificant compared to what has just happened. The way I find it easiest to explain this is the banks in 2008 were rather like our coal mines in 1910. Our coal mines in 1910 were producing the most coal ever, and we were shipping that coal all around the world, and we were making quite a lot of money, partly because we forced people to buy it, because we had to own their country. And if you imagine in 1910 that suddenly all the coal had turned to water in the coal mines, and all your shipyards had also crumbled, and the textile mills in Manchester had burned down and couldn't be rebuilt. That's the equivalent of what happened in 2008 to our banking industry. People sometimes say, why didn't they bail out the miners or industry in the way they bailed out the banks? It's because the banks crashed at the height of their profit making. They weren't making profits in a nice way. They weren't doing something useful, socially useful. But they were making an enormous amount of money, 12% of our GDP with just 4% of our population. And that's not coming back. John McDonald and Jeremy Corbyn wouldn't want to bring it back. They're not going to be able to replace that amount of money with anything else. We're not going to have a kind of profitable green revolution that is suddenly going to make a magic money tree appear. We have become poorer, and so we need good ideas that are new and different and will work in a time with less money. And we also need to contend with people like him. This is James Forsyth. He's the political editor of the Spectator magazine and writes for the Sun. And he wrote an article very recently claiming Theresa May, we may have selection in state schools already, selection by house price. And he's right, we do. I'll show you a map in a minute of Oxford. Yes, Oxford has selection in its state schools by house price. So you can't just tell people you want to keep what you've got, because lots of people don't like what you've got. You've got to offer them something better. There are lots of good reasons why we are such a mess. This little table is just showing that we are the most unequal country in Europe. Let's skip through a few so that I don't take too long to get on to it. That's just telling you people hate private schools. Most of the public don't like the idea of private schools. Only 7% of people get to go to them. These tables, which are unreadable, which I put them in so your tutors can look good, are basically telling you that people do like grammar schools. In 2014, there was a YouGov poll, even Labour supporters were majority in favour of a return to grammar schools. Every region of the UK, apart from Scotland, was narrowly in favour of grammar schools. This is why I say progressive politics has to come up with something better. These things are linked, by the way. This, again, is a map of Europe I showed you at the beginning. But with areas coloured dark, if there's a high proportion of migrants born in another country. And so Switzerland is that dark country in the middle, a place that spends twice as much for personal health care than us, and partly manages to provide a good health service because it has lots of migrant labour in its health service. I'm a geographer, so I can't not show you maps and can't carry on giving you geographical comparisons. But if you really want to see how things can be done differently, you get a chance to do it. Go to Bern, capital city of Switzerland. About the same size as Oxford. Surrounded by some very pretty mountains. There's at least two big differences in Bern from Oxford. One is that although it's around about the same size as Oxford, it's got about 24 platforms on its railway station, not four as we've got, because Swiss people use railways. They have public transport in more equal countries. And we're so unequal that I can use Switzerland as an example of a more equal country. You don't have to go to Scandinavia or Denmark or Norway, you can just look at Switzerland. They have so many trains in Switzerland that at night the trains simply stop where they are on the platforms because you couldn't have enough sidings to park them in. They don't stop there. I know they stop there in the main train station in Bern because I got to stay at the top of a tower block in the middle of Bern. A great big tower block that had been built in this beautiful city. Can you imagine building a tower block in the middle of Oxford? It wasn't that ugly a tower block, but it was essentially a tower block, and I think of at least 19 floors. And the tower block had been built there because it was right next to the hospital, and they used it to house very elderly people, lots of them with tubes stuck up their noses in wheelchairs, because they could wheelchair their way into the hospital and back. And when they weren't going to the hospital, they could look out of their window and they could see the city and the mountains. Can you imagine us doing that in Oxford? Building power blocks so that the elderly could look down on the quads of colleges. And that's where you have to look at other countries. Otherwise, you begin to believe that all kinds of things are completely impossible. Now, I'm not suggesting building tower blocks in Oxford, although colleges have left these nice squares and grasses in the middle, if you ever wanted. They might get used one time. Did any of you go on that march for refugees about a year ago? You remember that? There was a march for refugees in the middle of Oxford. A few hundred people were meant to turn up and several thousand turned up. And for the first time, a march went through Coal Market, which you're not allowed to do here. And people shouted out, who wants to help the refugees? And everybody put their hands up. And then the next person shouted out, who'll put a refugee up in their home? And everyone's hands went down. Because nobody's got a spare room in Oxford. The thing that struck me was that there are very few cities in Britain with just quite so much space that can put up marquees in the middle of town if you need to, or that have left all these fields conveniently round the edge, only 2.5 miles from the centre, where again you could suddenly house people. Now again, this will sound fanciful to you, where we're arguing about 10 people who may or may not be children having finally come in from Calais, but it just happened in Germany. Germany has just housed 1 million people in a very short amount of time, large numbers of them in tents under motorway viaducts. Numbers of things that have happened recently are more than happy. The reason for showing you that is just to show that it's most of mainland Europe which has high rates of migrants, it's the cities, and in the UK it is only London and Northern Ireland, two regions along with Scotland and voting for Maine. The more migrants you have, the more likely you are not to worry about migrants. Public service spending. This will be the last graph I concentrate on at all. Because it's really important. And it's just not known. We assume we're like other countries. This is showing a proportion of GDP spent on public services. This is what's going to pay for you. May already be paying for you. By 2020, we'll be spending just 36% of GDP on public services. A country like Finland spends 57% on public services. That's partly why Finland has got some of the best schools in the world, and why Finland, well, most of the rest of Europe, doesn't have a private health system. And as you can look carefully, you'll see France and Germany, even Greece, Sweden, Italy, Denmark, Norway, they'll all just tax and spend more. We've got it into our heads that that is bad, that people should make their own provision for their own housing, for their own care in old age, for their own education for their children if they can do so, and then the rest is kind of for a residuum, which sometimes happens to include 90% of the population. And we've had a government which has done budget after budget after budget like this, where the biggest cuts is in tax have been for the best top 10% and the least for the best top 10%. We've also had a government which has been doing all it can to make housing as expensive as possible. That's why George Osborne introduced various Help to Buy schemes and so on, because he was trying to push house prices up. It took me years to realise this, and it took it until somebody from the Treasury said, told me that you know we want house prices to rise, they said. I said, why? Don't you want people to be able to afford to be housed? The person on the Treasury said, no, it's market. And the higher the house prices are in London, the more successful that means that London is as a city. And if Oxford is expensive, that's just a sign that you are a successful city. And the talent and the successful people will come, and the inefficient people will have to leave. And until I was actually told this, I hadn't worked out why they were doing the policies that they were doing. Why this is interesting now, let's get towards reasons to be optimistic, is Philip Hammond has cut Osborne's scheme from the same that there will be no help to buy. So you'd be quick if you want to do it. If any of you have got a few tens of thousands of pounds and you want to buy a house in London for, say, £450,000, if you can find one, you put down a deposit 5%, we will lend you, that's us, taxpayers, we'll lend you 40% of the value, and then the bank will lend you the rest, and you can be in there. And the reason we lend you 40% of the value, up to 40%, is that the banks wouldn't lend that, because they don't think the market's that safe. So the government has been lending fairly affluent people money, backed up by us, so they can afford high house prices, partly to stop there being a fall in house prices, because they see how high house prices are a success, and because then their friends tend to own houses will benefit from them. The UK is a very strange country. You can get very depressed about all this. Why are we the most unequal country in Europe? Why do we have the highest spend on private schools of any OECD country apart from Chile? Why do we spend so little on our health? Why are our politicians such amazing idiots compared to the average politician of a mainland European country? You know, Angela Merkel, you might be told she's a right-wing German politician. We've had no Labour politician since the 1970s or earlier do anything that she's done. And it's partly because we didn't lose a war, we had an empire. What has made other countries better at policy than us is that things got shook up at some point in their relatively recent history. And that hasn't happened to us, and it hasn't happened that much to the United States. That's why the United States has Trump. That's why we've had Nigel Farage. Everybody, the rest of Europe gets far right parties. What makes me happy about Nigel and UKIP is becoming properly European. Means you've got to see the rise of a small, very nasty party. But if you're looking for patterns, we are much more like America than we are like the rest of Europe. I'm just going to show you two graphs that I think show what the problem with our schools is. Don't test people when they're 15 or 16. If you really want to know if they've learned something, test them a few years later. So this is a graph showing average math scores as measured by PISA across different countries. It's the latest data, comes from 2012. The lower your bubble, the worse your children on average do at age 15, 16. And on the bottom, we've got the income inequality ratio. So if it's far away from it, it's an unequal country, like the UK and the US. If you're near, like Japan, South Korea, Sweden, Germany, Italy, also then Spain, you're all equal. And children do a bit better at math tests at 15 or 16 in more equal countries. But this is the thing I can't get over. And we see the same thing in tests of literacy and problem solving, not just in maths. This is when you do the same maths test aimed at 15, 16 year olds, but later on up to age 24. We could do it now. I don't know who wants, I could pick somebody at random and get them to tell me what the square root of 81 is or something. I'm going to do it. But the reason that the US and the UK are way down there is that we're really bad at maths later on. And we're really bad at maths later on because we teach maths and other subjects in a way that helps you get an A rather than if you're going to get a B, or get a C rather than if you're going to get a D. But doesn't actually help you enjoy maths or learn it or have a feeling for what you're doing, so that later on, when you go to a landlord and there's some small print in the contract about fees and other things, you can actually understand what's going on. And we don't do that because the exams really matter. Because the exams are what determines whether you can stay on at school at 16. If you go to the school, state school mile over there, if you don't get 4 B's and 4 C's, you're out at 16. You discover this on the day you get your GCSEs. The parents don't know this. The children don't know it. The children who tend not to get 4 B's and 4 C's are the children who grew up in North Wales State, just down there, and across the state there. Really matters, because suddenly you've got to move school, and that school, Cheney, may be full, and suddenly you're moving again. And because we've got this really wide income differential in jobs, you don't want to get the bottom-end job because you don't live in poverty all your life, you want to try and get a higher-end job. What we need in education is cooperation rather than competition between schools, so schools can actually teach people so that we don't end up on the bottom of these league tables. Here's our schools in Oxford. I guess quite a lot of you, who is from Oxfordshire? Put your hands up. Great. Who was born in Oxfordshire? That's the biggest set of hands I've ever got, apart from, yeah, the talks in Oxford. Apart from a group of people suffering a severe mental illness. It's the only audience I've ever had where I got majority local. It's very funny. Because this is a city of migrants, so it's actually quite remarkable to get a group of adults if you have that number. Okay, so you know, I've got some idea of this. Apologies for you from outside the city. This is our state schools. There is a gap of about £100,000 in house price between each catchment area. I say catchment area carefully because the academy doesn't really have a catchment area. It always has spaces so anybody can go in the academy. It used to be called Pierce School. And it used to be Pierce School as a county grammar school. It was the poshest school in Oxford. 28% of children get 5 A stars to C because the middle class do all they can, a small proportion of the middle class of children live anywhere near the academy, do whatever they can to avoid their children going there. And because the teachers only stay for a few years, and you know they only stay for a few years because they're only 23, 24 years old. And 23, 24 year olds are very nice, but you can't staff an entire secondary school with 23, 24 year olds. Then there's Gregory the Great, the Catholic school on 47, then we get up to Spires, which used to be Oxford Boys at 58. Then you've got Cheney, only school not to change its name so far. All the schools, you have to change your name if you get lower ranked on the GCSE scores. 59%, 1,000, almost 400 children. And then Charwell, 1,800, heading up children, 72%, which is a school that will chuck you out if you don't get 4 Bs and 4 Cs. A little dot on there, by the way. We're going to get a new secondary school in Oxford. The site still hasn't been agreed. So, you see those fields down there? The college tried to sell them a few years for housing, and the residents of Old Henson objected. Because you wouldn't want the kind of people who might live there and the kind of housing that might have been built, including council housing. It was lost by one vote, so the fields are still there. They're actually described as agricultural land inside the ring road. You're going to have 800 children in there, that new building state over there very soon. These two schools are full. The college did want to make some money. Imagine having a secondary school just there between the two schools that are already full, opposite the set of new houses that are about to be built. Admittedly, with a mini road, which they're not going to build a bridge over yet, until somebody shames them into doing that. But we no longer have educational policy because we left it to the market. So the county council doesn't actually decide where the school goes. Somebody puts a bid in and says they want to create a free school. It was Toby Young. Fortunately, Toby Young bidding to set up the Oxford Free School cause people to do a counter bid, so we're going to get a different free school. But we don't know where it's going to be. But it will be open, I think, in about 12 months from now. Not that it has a site. It might be 24, they might have delayed it. It was supposed to be open 12 months from now. The children are ready to go into this school. There's no site, let alone any building started. Because you don't plan anymore, because it's a bad idea to plan. If you like what's happening in Oxford, it's an example of why you do want to do things in a better way in the market. I'm going to wait in about 5 minutes to start thinking of questions for me. My reason for putting up the map there isn't just to say where the new school should go, it's to talk about what you could actually do to stop there being selection by house price. What could you offer people in education that's better than offering them grammars? And my suggestion, and this is over a long time, just as you get their 20 or 30 years, is that we slowly merge these schools. We slowly merge the senior management teams of the state schools of Oxford so that they generally cooperate. We already have 800 cooperative schools in Britain. We don't know about this. It's a bit like we had quite a few comprehensives in the late 40s and early 50s that people didn't know. New ideas happen earlier than you get them. You begin to merge senior management teams. Say you were to start with Change Inspires, seeing as they have also identified GCSE results. Oops, get back. Not used to interactive whiteboards. The old university isn't quite there yet. You merge the senior management teams. That saves you money. Remember, the amount of money we're going to have is going to drop. You can then begin to move your teachers between the sites when you need them. You could just have one set of chemistry labs rather than two. It could be better than the chemistry labs that you have on both sites because you've merged them. You can move the children between the sites, and then suddenly why are you paying an extra £800,000 to live at the top end of Divinity Road rather than the bottom end of Divinity Road? However, the problem is, of course, people don't want their children to move around because they're scared of the cars. What could you do about that? Well, you just go and look to Europe. Well, they've done it sometime earlier, and you make the streets of Oxford safe for cycling so your children can cycle, because it's good if children cycle because they get less fat. Oxford is very small. I put the scale down there for how long it takes to move around. How do you make it safer for cycling? You take the main arterial roads, the London Road, Iffley Road, Avenue Road, Bambury Road, you make them one way for motorised traffic, and it gives you four lanes of cycling, and the traffic is very beautiful, goes very slowly. Sounds absolutely impossible, and that's exactly what people said about pedestrianising Cornmarket when I was growing up in this town. Cornmarket is now pedestrianised. And it's cheap. That's the key thing. Turning a road from two-way to one-way is much cheaper than building another road. It's the kind of thing you're going to have to do if you do want children to be able to move between school sites. And you need children to move between school sites if you're going to get rid of the problem with our schools at the moment that has built up with 2-3 decades worth of competition between schools. It's also the kind of thing you're going to have to do if you're going to put people living there and have more people from there coming into the city, because the city can't take any more cars. It can't even take many more buses. If you stand down at Cornmarket and just watch the queues of buses as they're going through. So you have to begin to plan to change it. But you don't have to be utopian, because we're so very bad. We have examples to see how this can be done. You can look at the Netherlands. 1% of our pensioners cycle in this country. 50% of the pensioners in the Netherlands cycle. That's the kind of thing you may have to be able to do. I'm going to begin to wrap it up, so I'll just leave that text up for people who are particularly bored. It's examples of just ways of thinking differently about how you do things. I do think we do need new ideas. Otherwise, the old ideas become very attractive. And simply defending the achievements of the 1970s isn't enough. You've got to say, what would be a better kind of schooling system in the future? Finally, why might we get this now? You may well be sitting there saying, this is just silly. He's come up from his little ivory tower down the bottom of the hill. He's telling us all these kind of things that could happen, and then he'll get on his bike and go back down to his ivory tower and write another article about it. Good things don't necessarily happen just because people argue for them and agitate for them and say it's a good idea. Good things often happen in this country simply because we run out of money to carry on being so stupid. This is a graph, a little graph over time, value of pound to the dollar. When my granddad was born, you could get $5 to the pound. When my mum was born, you could get 4. When I was born in 1960, you could get 3. When my first child was born, you could get 2. When I give it a year and a half, it's 1. The country has become relatively and dramatically poorer, and that long-term slide is not stopping. We got the NHS in 1948, partly because of agitation and campaigns for it, but mainly because the middle class could no longer afford to pay for a private doctor by late 1930s. The middle class wanted National Health Service. We got comprehensive schools in their droves in the 1970s because the middle class, when their children failed in 11 plus, no longer had enough money to send them to a private school. They didn't want their children going to a second bottom. We're about to run out of money again. And that isn't necessarily a bad thing, just as it wasn't a bad thing in 1948 and it wasn't a bad thing in the 1970s, because what it got us in both cases was something far better for decades afterwards. So when I started off depressing you about 52,000 deaths and 2.65 billion deficits and how it's all getting worse, it has almost always been, for some strange reason in this country in the last 150 years, when we haven't had enough money to carry on being quite as stupid, that we have made progressive jumps. And so I think you can think about a 2020 government or 2019 government or 2022 government actually doing something in constrained circumstances that could end up being quite good. Because we still are the, well, it's not fifth, it's now sixth, since Theresa May said that statement about being the most, fifth most rich country in the world, it changed. But we can slip quite a lot of the way down, and we are still not in that bad situation. Leave that to the universities. I'll leave that up as the last one. It's a quote I happen to like, because it's a man who was quoting educational statistics, as a man complaining that some children had six times more spent on education than other children. And he said, even if the money that was being spent on the children had less spent on them was more than in surrounding countries, it was still wrong and unfair that other children had six times as much spent on their education. The strange things about this quote is that this man was standing in the dock and quoting these statistics as a judge, and he was also doing it in the minutes before the judge had to decide whether he was going to hang him or not. And I don't know of anybody else in history who's quoted social statistics of somebody quite so blatantly before the person decides whether to kill them or not. And as you probably guessed, the person was Nelson Mandela back in the 1960s. And when he said it, people would have just thought, there's some fool complaining about something, and all that's going to happen is he's going to be hung or locked up for life. But in fact, the only speech you remember from any South African now from the 1960s is that speech. Everything which has ever got better was argued for in some obscure meeting and written in some obscure pamphlet 20 or 30 years before it began to become a reality. It's the only way things are ever improved is people arguing for them when you're in a minority and it seems strange. And then the circumstances in which it comes about and becomes better is not necessarily predictable. But the one thing that absolutely certainly happens is that everything changes. And so the idea that it's just going to be like this for year after year after year, you can certainly say that is absolutely wrong. What you have to do is to try and help people more understand why it's possible for things to get better. And most importantly, what better actually is. These two women both went to school in Oxfordshire. Only one of them went private and eventually went to a grammar, which was turned into a comprehensive. The other one went to Wood Farm School. And there's the motto of Wood Farm School, which I think is a very nice little motto about what we should do. The only reason why I change it is I say, and you should make a difference in the world, that makes it better. Because it's not that hard to make a difference in the world that makes it worse. But of course it's Francis O'Grady who went to the primary school on the council estate, the Carfax Tree,
and it's Theresa May who went to the private school and the convent school and the grammar school as a family trying to do whatever they could so that Theresa would never have to mix as a child with most people. Thank you very much. Who wants to ask a question? Oh. Put your hand up.
Is that why when mostly when you go to a house or to find a house, they are advised to leave you outside of Oxford?
I put up a map of when we built housing in Oxford, and it kind of stopped in the 1970s. That really is the first significant new housing that's been built. So the council has very, very little housing. They will essentially not be able to help you unless you have a child, particularly a very young child. And then, I told Sturber a year ago, you'd hope it got better, then they might offer you a flat in Coventry. There's housing association housing as well in Oxford, but it's very, very hard to get any of it unless you've got a child, preferably more than one child, and you'll be made homeless because it's gone. Partly because people have bought their council housing and the right to buy it and sold it on to landlords. Got a lot of landlords. A few landlords are inefficient landlords who just own one property and they think it's their pension. But they're very bad landlords on average. Because you can't just become a landlord. It's a skill, actually looking after a property and renting it out. In a sense, it's what my brother Adam really does. You know, I say he looks after children, leaving care and trying to see the children. What he actually does is he looks after the houses in which they live, looks after them, and makes sure that the houses that they live in don't fall apart completely, and tries to explain to them what you have to do when you live in a house and you're only 16, 17 and 18 so that the house is still there the next day and the boiler still works, you know, and it's a skill. I might laugh about it and, you know, make it sound easy, but I couldn't do it. I couldn't talk to a bunch of 17 year olds in a strange country who've just been allowed to live in their own in the first place about showing some respect to the property and what you do and deal with the authorities who are paying the rent and so on. But we are in a mess for housing. But it isn't just when you go to the council they can't give you somewhere. A friend of mine, well-paid, associate professor, partner in work, has tried to rent. And you're talking between £60,000-£70,000 income? A year? Went to landlord after landlord, who said no, property wasn't available, that one out of the market wasn't available. And the reason they said the property wasn't available is because they had a baby. And the landlord, why give somebody with a baby a tenancy when you can give a couple without a baby a tenancy? And then you don't feel so bad when you chuck them out. That's a free market for you. It took them a long time to find somewhere to private rent. The good news was they private rented somewhere normal in Oxford, rather than the posh part they were trying to rent in, because they would come from outside the city and they'd be told, oh, you must live there. So they got to live in a nicer part of the city. But it's housing is an incredible problem in the city, all the way up the social scale. There's house in North I was talking to somebody at the moment, tiny three-bed council land terrace, going for £400,000 because the house next to it has been extended, turned into two flats. One of the flats sold for £295,000 in March of this year. Those flats will be bought by landlords who will rent out these tiny flats. There is no policy to solve this for the city. You know, a tightening belt. We have a county, particularly South Oxfordshire, that comes all the way around here, doesn't want anything to happen. A government in London who just thinks the market's fine, it'll settle. Yeah.
going to say, it's not just sort of landlords that live here. In terms of places like London, you've got people, you've got rich millionaires and millionaires buying buildings and properties and stuff like that that are completely unoccupied.
Yeah.
They're not using anything.
Yeah. Okay, but I'll give you a positive side on this. You're right. We thought that when a basic three-bed house in London near a tube station went past a million, it would stop. Because you can really only charge somebody about £20,000 a year rent, because they don't have much more than that. And that's only a 2% return on your money, £20,000 to a million. But the price has carried on going up past a million in London, in those areas, because people were buying the property as an investment, not actually to make money out of the tenants. And that's why they started buying flats and leaving them empty, because they weren't interested. The really, really good news is that the top end of the market has crashed. The houses costing 10 or 15 million have started coming down rapidly. And the really good news is that the pound's falling. So if you're a Chinese factory owner and you bought a flat in London for 2 million, all those luxury blocks in the Thames, even if the flat carries on being worth 2 million, every day the pound drops, you're losing money. Part of the reason you leave the flat empty is because you want to be able to sell it quickly if you have to. I'm just a little bit hopeful that our overseas investors are not so stupid that they hang on to this property and they will begin to sell. When they begin to sell, prices of property a bit lower, stagnates or begins to fall. When prices begin to fall, landlords stop buying, because you don't want to buy an asset that's falling in value. They're only buying at the very bottom of the market in London right now. First time buyers stop buying, because you could lose £10,000 by buying a month earlier. You could get yourself in negative equity of £100,000 quite easily at the moment if you're buying now. And the reason why this is something that doesn't worry me at all is that London and Oxford are the most expensive places on the planet at the moment. It's a housing bubble. They all eventually go. And we can only do really different things when we have big financial crises. And if the value of housing is going to fall, we will get a very large financial crisis in the country. But that might be what it takes to actually say your housing is something that you have to shelter people and not something that the market helps sort out. Because the housing market crash is a market failure. Should we just do a couple more? So then, any other questions?
Children in the care sector, do you think they have enough help? And can you see the help that they get at the moment dying?
Producing out. If you step back and take a long historical view, it's so much better than it was. You know, we've closed down all these big children's homes that we know are terrible. We've got small children's homes with just a few children in them that are safer. We safeguard up to 19. You know more than me about this, so I won't say any more to embarrass myself. But if you go back decade and decade and decade, we have got better. The danger is that if we've got callous about our old people, do we next become callous about young people who are on the margins of society? We've already beginning to do it about young people who find themselves homeless. We're accepting rising street homelessness levels again. It's about sentiment. It's about, to what extent do we see other people like us, and to what extent can we be taught not to? So if you can teach people to see migrants as somebody strange who's coming to threaten your way of life, you can end up with a more callous system. If you show a photograph of a toddler on the beach in Turkey who's just died, suddenly you think of them as a human. If you talk about welfare cheese scamming housing benefits, you can get angry. If you show Kathy and her pram with that film, which is having its anniversary this year, you begin to worry. I think what's required is getting people to see other people like them, and if they don't, then they will behave very badly. At the extremes, this is how you go to war.
we could only go to war with Germany in the First World War because we could teach people to believe that the Hun was a kind of animal to be shot and you weren't shooting another human being. The one way to help people understand that other people are like them is to get people to think about their extended families. What are their siblings doing? What are their cousins doing? As you get older, what is happening to your children and your cousins' children? And in all but the most affluent of families, somebody will be losing out and it won't be going well for somebody. And if you have children or nephews and nieces, you can think about the next generation down and the next generation down. And one of your great-grandchildren will, odds on, be somebody who may need, be a child in need of care. And if you agree that we shouldn't support people like that, you're condemning your descendants, the one who's in the weakest position, to a much worse life. I'm not putting it very well. It's put much better by journalists and people who tell stories. But I think there's a difficulty about how you raise empathy levels. People vary in their degree of empathy. Right-wing politicians and business leaders, when measured, are often remarkably bereft of any empathy. Often confused about the very idea of empathy. You know, why would you care about somebody else? What would make you do that? That's the stupid thing. You know, they're them. And it's often not their fault. People actually vary in inherent levels of empathy. You know, the extreme psychopaths don't have any. That's why they're psychopaths. Most people are pro-social, which is why human beings still exist. So a long rambling answer. If we see those children as deserving and like us, then they will get good care. If we don't, they won't. So when a pop star from the 1960s is accused of having abused children, we suddenly see those children, who we never know who they are, or as a child abuse inquiry as it is now. We have in our heads these children who we want to protect and we care about. But you can very easily change that image. And it depends on the feeling that other people are like you. If you believe that you're different and special, so let's do it for me. I've got special genes. My mum and dad are very clever. They had special genes and they made me. I did very well at school. You wouldn't have done as well as me at school. So I should get paid more. You won't appreciate what it is like to live in the kind of house I have with the art on the wall I've got. Because I know about art, where you've probably never been to the opera. But I care about you. In the same way as I worry about the sheep that are on that field there, you want to look after them. And we also want to make sure society is well ordered and worked. But we need some people who properly understand art and the higher things in life, otherwise civilization will break down. And because my child needs to go to a boarding school that's going to cost £35,000 a year, because he deserves it, I'm afraid I can't pay a level of taxation that means we can afford to have somebody looking after a 19-year-old that's on their own. They really just need to pull themselves up from their bootstraps. And that worked in the past in Victorian times, why can't it work again? And you can have a quite rational argument for cutting. And I often hear arguments like that because of who I now mix with. Last question, now I should let you go. Who's got one? You can't complain about not being allowed. Anything? Right to the back, very last one.
Thank you very much for coming to speak at our student day. I know you came a few years ago. You gave a great talk on inequality, and I know your books are fantastic in explaining that. It seems to me that what you're talking about is the problem around market forces. But you've not mentioned neoliberalism, which is the ideology which supports those market forces, because everything you're describing actually starts from 1979, the sort of neoliberal agenda. I think there are things that can be done about that, not least getting the rich people to pay their tax, because that's something we're not very good at. And when we give examples, comparative examples across Europe, what those countries do that we don't do, to get people to pay tax. And actually, we can't have a welfare state, we can't have good schools, we can't have hospitals if we don't pay for them. And then we pay for them to get people to pay the tax. But the final thing is, I think it's also something that you said about how market forces doesn't work in health, education, housing. Market forces doesn't work in business, it doesn't work in economics, which is why we're having to pay £40,000 for each family to bail out the rich that you refer to the credit crunch. So I think we've got to name the ideology that backs this, which is neoliberalism. That's the driver. And more than that, it's not just saying this is neoliberalism, but it's actually saying people present it as if it's the only show in town, in my opinion.
Yeah. I largely agree with you, but the question is, why was it neoliberalism so much in this country, and what reserves did people manage to have in the other countries in Europe that allowed them to hold it back? At what point do we accept that it was a mistake? We're beginning to. You could theoretically in the 1970s have played out the arguments and have said it might work, it might raise everybody's boats. There's now no way you can defend it, it's so easy to show it's wrong. Where we would probably disagree over a point is, and this is one problem that the left has, because it doesn't know where it wants to quite end, is that this is all the others. This is why you've got a wide Labour Party and all that hate inside it. It doesn't know where its cut-off is for securing the means of production by hand and by brain. And mine is about things where you can't be in a position to be a consumer, but it's inefficient. But I can't believe that you ever get better socks if socks are made by a state-controlled enterprise. A co-op, I'll go for. I suspect that there is a place for private enterprise music, although much better to make music on the dole, which is not allowed anymore. Private enterprise is very, very dangerous. It allows the greedy to rise to the top, because you do best in business if you're greedy than somebody else. It allows people to really exploit people. But there's also a danger of providing things arranged by committee or co-op or by the state, when, because it is so small and you are such clever consumers on small items, you could possibly get a better deal from the market. But this is a problem, because we're not going to come to an agreement and people don't have a line. We can easily get dismissed as you don't really know what you're talking about. Whereas the free marketeers are clear. Everything, even lighthouses and ambulances, for them should be in the free market. They only believe in the state to defend the free market, which is why the state has to have force and power and guns to stop people who might want to stop their free market being free. And they don't have a line. They would like for there to be charging in the health service. If you want to ask me afterwards, you can try and tell me where you think they've got the line, and I'll tell you a politician on the far right who will explain why it's even a bad idea to fund lighthouses. Because nowadays, people should buy their own radar system and work out where the rocks are. So that kind of public good is no longer needed. And really, we shouldn't be providing that for free for lazy mariners who can't look after their own interests. Because there's no such thing for society but only yourself, and maybe, if you care a bit, your family. We're getting to the end of it. You know, we know that there is such a thing as society because we are in it, and many of us are suffering from how we have arranged it, including many very, very well-off people who find it very hard to buy a very simple house that most average people could buy some time ago. But when you get to a situation where 95% of people are roughly in the same kind of boat of this is not working for me, which we have in the NHS, we have in comprehensive schools, that what was seen as impossible becomes possible, and we are potentially very, very near to that at the moment. Thank you very much.